Good morrow!
I'm Allison.
I'm Beverly. Welcome back to Shaky Understanding.
This week, we are talking about Henry VI, Part 1.
Part 1.
Part 1.
Of 3. Not of 3. Five.
Unlike Fantastic Beasts.
Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So, history is not my strongest suit, so Allison is going to take the lead on this week's Shakespeare Abridged.
So, King Henry V is dead, okay? His funeral is attended in the first scene by a bunch of noblemen who are like, man, I'm so sad that King Henry's dead. And then some more people show up at the funeral and they're like, guys, I know you're really sad, but we've got some serious stuff going down in France. So there are a bunch of towns in France that Henry V won, and they've been lost back to the French, to the Dauphin Charles, who has now been crowned king, and the English hero Talbot has been taken prisoner in France. And so hearing this, all the noblemen at the funeral are like, oh no, man, we gotta get ourselves together and go get stuff done. So they each take on a different task to kind of reorganize the kingdom and then help to prepare the new king, King Henry VI, King Henry V's son, if you didn't see that coming, for some duties in France, because they got to get over there and get stuff back in line. Meanwhile, cut to France, you see Talbot's forces laying siege to Orleans, while Charles, the king of France, and all of his lords try and figure out how to get their way out of that situation. But the English beat them, and then a new surprise arrives on scene to try and help the French. You might know her. Joan. Joan arrives, she meets Charles, and she says, you know, that she has visions, and she's hearing voices, she's been speaking directly to God, and she can lead the troops. Charles challenges her to single combat to prove her worth, and she beats him. So he says, alright, cool, you can be in the lead, you can be in charge, that's fine. So she announces that the French will break the siege that very day and trust in her, and she will rescue France. Then we cut back to London. The protector of the kingdom, Gloucester, who will rule until King Henry VI is old enough to take over, comes and he has a whole scene with the leader of the church, Winchester. And they meet up at the Tower of London. Winchester bars Gloucester from entering the tower and basically says, you're trying to take over the kingdom and I'm not going to let you do it. And then each of them have their own, you know, serving men, footmen by them, and they start fighting as well. And then the mayor of London shows up and he's like, guys, cool it. Just cool it. Then we go back to France. Talbot, the English hero, has been released in exchange for a captured French lord. And the French launch an attack on the English forces. They kill a bunch of important people. Don't get too attached to anyone in this play, a la Game of Thrones. Then Talbot and Joan fight, and Joan actually gets the upper hand on Talbot, but then she says to Talbot that it's not his time to die, and she runs off, essentially. She does succeed in lifting the siege, and the French nobles celebrate her success, and everybody's partying, but Talbot engineers a sneak attack on Orleans and retakes the city, and then he decides that he will bury all of his dead comrades within the city. While this is happening, the Countess of Avignon sends for Talbot, and she says that she wants to see this great English hero, this English lord, in person. So Talbot goes to the castle, and the Countess basically goes, ha-ha, I've trapped you! You've fallen for my plot! And Talbot's like, yeah, right, lady. Like, I don't have all my soldiers following me. This ain't my first rodeo. So his soldiers arrive, and, you know, things don't go so well for the Countess after that. Then we go back to London. In London, many of the lords gather in the Temple Gardens outside of Parliament to dispute some law, and Richard, Plantagenet, and Somerset form the heads of opposing camps, and they each begin plucking a white rose and then a red rose as symbols of their opinions on this law. Hello, War of the Roses, getting very symbolic here. And then all of the people that are in their camps begin to do the same. So if you're agreeing with one of them, you're going to have a white rose. If you're agreeing with the other, you're going to have a red rose. And then things just get nasty. They were just talking about a law, and then Somerset insults Plantagenet's father, and they start just really kind of being dicks to each other. And Warwick, one of the lords who's there, predicts that the argument, though it was begun over something so small, will end in the deaths of thousands. So, quite foreseeing the future there. Then Plantagenet goes to the Tower of London to talk to his uncle Mortimer and to ask more about his father. Mortimer then lets Plantagenet know that his father was once in line to the throne and he had raised an army to help claim his right to power, but he was captured and executed while the rest of the Mortimer line, including the Mortimer who's doing the talking, was suppressed. And then that Mortimer, I suppose, because his heart was so broken over this history, dies. Told you, don't get too attached. And Plantagenet leaves, becoming even more anxious about, you know, trying to get the throne and get his birthright. Then all of Parliament learns of Gloucester and Winchester's dispute because their servants come crashing into the room, pelting each other with stones. And King Henry VI at this point, says, guys, please, like, let's not fight, okay? Let's be grown-ups here. Don't pelt each other with stones. If we start fighting with each other, then it's going to weaken the whole nation. A house divided against itself cannot stand, as it were. So the two serving men promise to stop fighting for the moment. Warwick presents Plantagenet's request to have his father's title passed on to him, and the king grants it, also giving Plantagenet his uncle's former title, and thus renaming him the Duke of York. Keep that in mind. Gloucester urges the king to go to France and to deal with all the issues there, because the English are being defeated, and then winning, and then being defeated. So, hot mess. The king needs to get over there. And so he agrees to do that. Exeter comments on the growing factionalism, growing between the noblemen's quarrels with Gloucester and Winchester, and then Plantagenet, who's now the Duke of York and Somerset. And he refers to a prophecy stating that Henry VI would lose all the territories that his father had won for Britain. Ooh, better get to France fast. So back in France, Talbot's forces stand outside Rouen, preparing for an attack, and the French and English forces insult each other repeatedly, like, going to fart in your general direction, because that's a great movie. Talbot asks the French to meet him in the field and just fight a fair fight rather than using the walled city to their advantage, and they refuse, because they're smart. The English forces manage to beat the French forces anyway. They kind of sneak through the wall and get in there. Joan tells Charles not to worry about the loss because she has a new plan to weaken Talbot. Burgundy, a French leader fighting with Talbot and kind of constitutes the only threat to her plan. So she lures him into the French camp and convinces him that he's fighting for the wrong side. And the Duke of Burgundy goes, you're right, I should fight for France, for my people. What was I thinking? Then Henry arrives in Paris with his nobles. Talbot goes to greet him, where he receives a message from Burgundy, basically saying, peace out, I'm fighting for the French now. And Talbot goes with his forces to try and talk to the Duke of Burgundy and get him to switch back. Meanwhile, two underlings of York and Somerset ask the king for the right to have an armed fight, because the king won't let them pelt each other with stones, so maybe he'll condone a brief joust. Who knows? This is the first that the king learns of the struggle between the two followers, the White Rose and the Red Rose. And so the king says to Somerset and York, previously Plantagenet, to just put aside their differences while they're in France because, again, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And we are here in France. We gotta win all these battles, keep all this land my father won. So can you guys just, like, put it on the back burner for now? And he says it shouldn't matter what rose anyone is wearing, and since he loves both sides, he'll wear any rose, it doesn't matter. But he picks a red rose, which is for Somerset's side, and York is furious, but keeps it to himself. Henry then assigns the two men new tasks in France, making York the leader of the English troops and putting Somerset in charge of the cavalry. So it should be fair and equal and everyone should be happy. Talbot then prepares to attack Bordeaux, but the city is well defended and Charles's forces approach from behind and Talbot is trapped. A messenger from Talbot asks York to send the cavalry reinforcements to save him, but York is not in charge of the cavalry, so he can't do anything. Convinced that Somerset has delayed the delivery of the cavalry out of dislike for him, York is going, now Talbot's going to die and we're going to lose all these lands and it's all Somerset's fault. The same messenger then goes to Somerset, who says York is to blame for sending Talbot into battle without sufficient troops and it's not his fault, and that York probably did this on purpose, wanting to take over Talbot's post. The messenger says Somerset should have helped Talbot, and his death will be both noblemen's shame. Like, it's both your fault, guys. Get it together. Then we have a really sad scene, guys. Talbot's son John arrives on the battlefield, and he's come just basically to learn the art of war from his father, and Talbot is going, no, son, I'm gonna die, and you need to leave. And the son's like, no, Dad, if I leave, it's gonna bring shame onto our whole house, and I can't do that, and I love you so much, I need to stay here and fight with you. And Talbot's like, no, I don't want you to die, you should really leave. And the son's going, no, I'm definitely gonna stay. So Talbot's son John ends up staying, and then they both die, because John is killed, and then Talbot dies of grief, and the English army is defeated. Sad day. Back in London, Gloucester reads letters from the Pope urging the English to make peace with the French. Everybody just needs to play nice in this play. So Charles, the King of France, agrees to make an offer. And in France, his forces are under attack by the united front of Somerset and York, who put aside their differences to try and win. Joan then has a scene where she calls to her voices, her angels, to God to come and advise her about the future, but the voices are silent, and York captures Joan in battle. Now, in the course of these battles, Suffolk has captured Margaret, a French girl, who is daughter of one of Charles's nobles, Renee, and she's very beautiful, and he really wants to marry her, but he's already married. So he decides, better plan, I will woo her for King Henry and get them to marry, and then I'll keep her close, and I can have all kinds of plots and things going on. So he does that, and Margaret's pretty impressed and pretty down with this plan. Now, Joan has been captured, so York and Warwick hold Joan in trial. They ask her if it's true that her father was a shepherd, but she refuses to acknowledge this. She tries to convince them that they shouldn't kill her because she's a virgin and she's pure and able in her purity to communicate with God and all of these higher powers, and they basically go, nah, we're gonna burn you at the stake anyway. So then she has a total change of heart and claims that she is pregnant and they wouldn't dare kill a pregnant woman, but York goes, nah, we're done. You're gonna die anyway. So she curses the English and is led away, and as you are probably aware, is then burned at the stake. Meanwhile, Winchester tries to engineer some peace between King Charles of France and the English, and at first Charles resists, but his nobles say, no, you should, you know, do some peace for the moment so that people stop dying, and then we can always break the treaty later. So, you know, in the meantime, let's save some lives. So that's what happens. And then Suffolk arrives in London, where he tells the king of Margaret's charms, and Henry decides she sounds pretty great and he's gonna marry her. But Gloucester reminds him he's already engaged to the daughter of a relative of Charles, a match that would suit international politics and be a much, much better marriage. Margaret's father, Rene, he's only like a minor earl. He doesn't really have any money, no status. A union with her offers no real advantages. There's no point to doing that. But Henry insists on marrying her and tells Gloucester, you kind of just have to deal with it. I'm the king, I'm gonna do what I want. So Suffolk has now succeeded. Margaret will rule the king, and he will rule Margaret, and he is seeming to have a conniving plot beginning, but that's the end of part one. So you have to tune in and find out what happens next. All right, guys.
You're my hero.
Listen, as complicated as that sounds, and as ridiculous as it was to say all of that out loud, I know you probably didn't follow all of it, but here's what I will say. I loved this play. I was into it. I am a history nerd and a history buff, and this play really focuses on that aspect and not as much like Othello does, which, though I love it, is much more of a, like, a character piece of, like, you're following this story. And this one, it truly just feels like an entire season of Game of Thrones.
So we have here today Richard of York now, right? Plantagenet himself.
Correct.
Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's quite a life. Quite a lot going down in England at the time.
Yes. That's an understatement.
I was a little befuddled by your story. This is a lot of people you're dealing with. It seems like everyone has their own underlying motive versus what they're saying out loud.
Yes, that is an accurate statement. Mm. There's a lot of in-between thought going on.
A lot of political machinations.
Oh, yes. Mm. Machinations, that's a good word for it.
Here's a question. What does "beard thee to thy face" mean? The bishop says it to Gloucester in, like, Act 1.
I don't know. Let me see the context. Am I dared and bearded to my face? Beard, defy, literally, pull insultingly by the beard.
All right, that's what I thought. There we go. This is the quote of my life.
All right, go ahead.
No, truly, it is more than manners will, and I have heard it said, unbidden guests are often welcomest when they are gone. Real. I don't like people showing up that I don't know are coming. So then, if you left, I'd be real happy. The Countess is dope.
That scene comes out of nowhere, because pretty much the whole play, it's like, battle scene, political intrigue in the castle, battle scene, and then we're at this Countess's house, and, I mean, she lays this very loose trap of being like, you're in my house now, I've captured you.
It's going to the Eyrie, to the Eyrie.
I guess, but is it, like, speaking to France? Like, why is that there?
I see what you mean. Like, what actual purpose does it serve in the plot?
Is it that the French are now underestimating the English? Is that the purpose of it?
I don't think that Shakespeare is particularly well known for having the tightest plots in terms of, like, the cleanest plots, I should say. Because there is one scene, it may even be in here, that I made a note of it, and I thought to myself, why does this scene exist? I don't think it was this play, it was something else. But it's basically two servants, I think, and they're just, like, talking to each other about nothing. And I think it's, like, a costume change cover.
Could be.
I don't think that's what this is. I think there's probably a different reason, and it may be that it's just historically accurate, and that did happen, and so he's throwing that in there. I just think she's such a dope character.
Yeah, she's pretty cool.
To have one scene and walk out and be like, ha ha, have you know?
Gotcha.
And then it's like, ah, no, you don't.
So let's talk about
the rose Plantagenet scene,
and the roses scene. In general.
Yes. That little feud.
So have you guys been fighting, like, a long time? Like, has this been coming for a long time?
Since the death of our beloved King Henry V. May the gods be kind to him. Our camps have differed in our ideals. There are some of us that dutifully follow the rule of the new king. And there are those of us that seek other means of rule, as it were.
Is there any particular reason that you chose a white rose?
White has always, at least in particular to me, white has always symbolized purity and honesty and justice.
I like it.
And your character does seem to say over and over that he's honest. In that rose-picking scene, he says, like, you can see my honesty, I wear it on my sleeve, whereas you all, dot, dot, dot.
That would be the honesty part of it, yes.
Calling them out, so to speak.
Yes, calling them out, as you say.
Oh, it is this play. It's Captain Falstaff and Soldier. Sorry.
Fastolf.
Whatever, they have a scene.
John Falstaff, May God rest his soul.
Yes, okay. John Falstaff, not to be confused, is dead. We will come to him during the Henry IV series. But there's another soldier who's cowardly named Fastolf.
Okay.
Which may have been Shakespeare just like, your character you love is still dead. I don't know.
But they have a whole scene about nothing. They have a scene about nothing.
Weird.
Mortimer, a.k.a. Exposition Man.
Easy.
Oh.
Easy. Oh. That was my father you're talking about.
Wait, is it your father?
No.
But he was like a father to you.
Yes.
But like he was your uncle?
But he was my uncle, yes. Mm.
Do you have any children?
Yes. Yes, I do.
As you have now presumably passed to the other side, are you able to ever observe any of your children's doings in the world?
Oh, unfortunately.
Do you have any comments that you would want to share on that subject?
We have met one of your children.
Ah,
which? Who is Richard III. I'm so sorry. We read that story.
I unfortunately had to witness all of that third hand, and Richard.
Poor wife.
Richard, why? Ugh. That is not what we stand for.
Were you just, like, up there, and then all of a sudden, like, Clarence was there, and you're like, what? Why are you? And
yeah, essentially.
And then all of a sudden,
everyone else started popping up.
Everyone's
dear.
And seemed to talk to you for some reason, all of a sudden.
Well, as they say, dying is the end of human misery.
I disagree with that.
He did not have that experience.
I think that was the beginning of my misery.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, if you're keeping track, so Richard III is Richard of York here's son.
He's my son, yes.
And he's growing up during these stories. And I believe we meet him in the third part.
You do, yes.
So he'll be there.
At the very least, right before I die.
But back in this story.
He's but a young lad.
Yes.
He's not even sent to learn about war from you, like young John Talbot.
Oh, don't remind me about John Talbot. Oh, that was a sad story. He had such promise. He did. If he was anything like his father, he had such promise.
Yeah.
And then they both died.
But that was a huge hit for England, too.
Oh, yes. Talbot was one of our greatest. And then he died of heartbreak, much like my uncle did.
Mm.
That and old age, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely don't get attached to people in this
get attached to people in history in general.
Understatement.
Can I share some favorite lines from this play that I have?
Please do.
Please.
One, dying is the end of human misery.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
His fame lives in the world, his shame in you.
Ugh.
Ultimate burn.
Woof.
Ultimate burn.
Woof.
Also, this is probably my new favorite thing to say when I'm angry. Oh, were mine eyeballs into bullets turned, that in rage I might shoot them at your faces.
Dang.
Oh, that is a good line.
I'd cry if you said that to me.
Snap. I would never say that to you.
Oh my god. Dude, Joan of Arc.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, Joan of Arc. Do you have thoughts on her that you would want to share? You were at her trial, and now you've, from the other side, also seen what she has become.
Has become quite a legend.
How do you feel about how do you feel about burning a saint?
Well, at the time, it was presumed she had otherworldly powers.
Right.
That would not stand in our society, so we had to do what was done because it needed to.
Mm.
Because we couldn't have that leading or even in a position of power in our country.
The witchcraft.
Exactly. The witchcraft.
Which is what she was tried for, partially.
Yes. On top of that, accusations of adultery, child rearing, bastardization.
She's a slut and a mom.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes.
The monologue that she has, where she's imploring to the angels and the demons and her voices to speak with her, how come nobody ever brings that up as a Shakespeare monologue for women to do?
I don't even remember it.
It's beautiful. As you are probably aware, dear listeners, if you've been following our journey, I'm not a Shakespeare fan. I will say that that's changing.
Yeah.
But I was not prior to the beginning of this year. And so often as a theater person, you are told to bring in essentially a Shakespeare monologue and a contemporary monologue, and I always said I will be doing a monologue from St. Joan by George Bernard Shaw, because that is considered a classic, and I will not be doing Shakespeare. I wish someone had said to me, like, hey, Joan of Arc is also in Henry VI Part 1. Why don't you read that and look at her monologues? I had no idea she was even in this play or part of this story, and her monologue is just great. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece, and I would love to just see it staged and the staging of it. I would really like to see this play live, because it is a very Game of Thrones type story, and I think to see it live and to see it performed, so then you don't have to follow as much, you know, who is on whose side when you're just reading it, you can visually see that. To me, this play is like nonstop action. Mm-hmm. I read it pretty quickly.
I did not read this quickly. I didn't even read it on my own. And I was still like, let's hang out. Let's get a snack. Yeah, so if Shakespeare is hard for you to get through sometimes, that's okay. It's hard for all of us. I love Shakespeare, and this play was hard for me to get through. I also didn't know that Joan of Arc was in it before I read it. I opened it and was like, oh, list of characters, Joan of Arc.
I think the other reason I really enjoyed this play is because I kept wanting it to get back to her, to her story, because you usually see her portrayed from the French perspective, mm-hmm. I guess you would say, mm-hmm. or, you know, she's the hero or the heroine of the piece, and it's very interesting to see her from the English point of view and to see her as the villain and to truly see this idea that she would have supernatural powers and how that would threaten the English monarchy.
I felt like Joan of Arc was very much like Anthony in Julius Caesar, where she's like this young gun soldier who's like on the edge and is like, no, I can do anything. And then her overconfidence leads to them losing some battles and stuff. And then she's like, well, it's not my fault. I was asleep.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Her pompousness. Yeah. Do you have anything else that you would want to share, Richard of York? Even just like, what was the food like in your day? So did you go down to the tavern?
It's a lot of meat. Either of you are whatever they call it now.
Vegan?
Yeah, that one.
Vegan?
You would not have lasted a day.
What? No. I could have found something. I could find something anyway.
We would have probably called you a witch and burned you at the stake.
Oh, gosh.
Most likely.
Never mind. Not a vegan. Not me.
Yes, your analogy and your draw between this Game of Thrones and your Game of Thrones is very, very apt.
Yeah. Ah, yes.
I was even thinking the way that they marry, too, because
yes.
Rob, spoilers for season 2, 3 of Game of Thrones.
Guys, if you're not caught up yet, just
turn, Shakespeare, Game of Thrones
shame
is more
you.
Important than Shakespeare. So,
Whoa! Oh my god! I need that on a t-shirt.
But honestly, like, come on. Guys, come on. Oh my god, so many English teachers are gonna write me a letter. But
it will prep your mind for Shakespeare.
Yeah, use it as a tool. There you go.
Yes.
But the storyline with Robb Stark, he's supposed to marry for politics.
Oh, that's right.
He ends up falling in love with the pretty girl who can heal wounds, and he ends up marrying her, and it messes everything up.
I hadn't even thought about that parallel.
Hashtag Henry VI.
Yes.
I just thought more about everyone standing around being like, plotting.
Yeah, very King's Landing.
Because it's very interesting, too, in reading the play, I didn't quite catch it, and then when I was looking over summaries and stuff to prepare for my abridged version, it basically says that you, York, and Somerset are just arguing about a point of law. It's not even very clear about which point or why you're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes into this whole crazy war for a difference of opinion, which I suppose is why wars start.
That is why most wars are fought, but yes.
But do you want to speak at all about what spurred that discussion? The point of law that was in dispute?
Those not following the law are not on the side of justice.
Ah. All right.
And if we don't follow the law, then we're plunged into chaos.
Precisely.
And then there's another situation that's starting to heat up between Gloucester and...
Winchester.
Mm.
And that seems to be that Gloucester wants to protect the crown and protect the king, and Winchester wants to take over the power.
Yes.
And wants to make the god aspect of society, the church, more powerful than the king.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes a cardinal in this play at one point.
Right.
Which is, like, more power.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Gloucester are always butting heads about that. So we have, like, those two factions fighting. We have the Plantagenets and the Lancasters
fighting. Eventually the Lancasters.
Sorry, yes. Yeah, Somerset's right now.
Yeah.
And then you have France and England fighting.
It's just wars within wars within wars.
It's like a babushka doll of wars.
I believe those are matryoshkas?
Maybe.
Yeah, babushka means babushkas, grandmother. Yes.
I think Tim Minchin calls them babushka dolls. And that's why I've called them that. Because he has a song and he goes, it's kind of like when you're feeling like the smallest babushka doll in a set. He's like, that's when I wrote this song. So you're welcome. Look it up. It's my favorite song. It's called Not Perfect. So, for our technical aspect history, I decided to research Joan of Arc. And I just looked up what she actually did. So, she was born to a shepherd, didn't learn to read or anything, but was taught about the Catholic Church very young, and that was very influential in her childhood. And while she was growing up in France, it was war-torn. It was part of the Hundred Years' War, which ended with Henry V being named as ruler of England and France when she was just 8 years old. So she, like, grew up bathed in war, basically. 2 years later, Henry VI succeeded Henry V, and her town was one of the cities that was kind of taken over, and they ended up having to leave because they were going to maybe get invaded. When she was 13, she started to hear the voices.
Mm.
She was, like, convinced that they were voices sent from God, that they were telling her that she needs to devote her life to God and to bringing France back to the rightful ruler. So she took a vow of chastity when she was 13, and her dad once tried to marry her off, and she was like, no, Dad, I can't, and literally went to court about it. It was like, here's why I can't be married off, because I made a vow of chastity. God needs me to take care of France, and blah, blah, blah. And then she won. It's crazy. And then she wanted to help out immediately. So she's 14. She went to a camp that had a bunch of followers of Charles, who is the king that should have been king of France. Charles, the Dauphin in our play. And she says, you need to let me talk to the should-be king. And they're like, no way. And then all these followers started learning about her. And there's a prophecy that a virgin was going to save all of France. And so they decided that must be her, and so she got enough followers. They're like, okay, here, he's at this castle. She travels to Chinon, and when she goes there, she disguises herself as a man and cuts her hair, which is going to be important later. And so she gets to the royal palace, and she earns his respect, but no one was in the room where it happened, and so no one knows what they said or how she convinced them. They just said that she said something only a messenger of God would know. So she promises to get him crowned king as long as he helps her get forces and so she can go take back Orleans. And she does, and even though his advisors are like, that's a terrible idea, don't go attack that. She's like, no, I got it. She's 17 years old and led an army in white armor on a white horse and wrecked and took the city back. And then she escorted Charles to Reims, where he was went to his coronation to become King Charles VII. But then things went downhill. She tried to take back Paris, but was defeated. And then she was sent to defend Compiègne, and she was captured when she was locked out of the town gates without a horse. And that is when the English had her in jail, basically. And they accused her of 70 different accusations, including being a witch, heresy, dressing like a man, and it's partly to discredit her and all of the things, like, and her place as a messenger of God, and partly to establish Charles as a false monarch, because he wouldn't have been crowned without her. So if they discredit what she is and what she did, then it would seem like Charles didn't have right to the throne. So because that, Charles didn't attempt to rescue her or negotiate to get her out of there. And after a year of captivity, and they were like, worried they're going to kill you or you're going to sign a confession for all of these sins, she ends up signing a confession. And then after that, she ends up dressing like a man again. And they're like, nope, nope, you're going to be put to death. You can't do that. And at 19, she was burned at the stake, which is crazy. So all of this happened within 8 years, pretty much. Mm. And then 20 years later, King Charles VII had another trial for her, clearing her name and being like, oh, this was done by these people. This was probably once he was comfortably in charge of France. Mm-hmm. And then hundreds of years later, in 1920, Pope Benedict XV named her into the canon of saints, and she became Saint Joan.
And she is the patron saint of France.
Patron saint of France. So actually, Shakespeare's pretty accurate in this. There's just like a couple of battles that she actually wouldn't have been at
mm-hmm.
in here, but for the most part.
And it is rumored a lot that they dressed everyone up as Charles before she came in to try and trick her and see if she would know who the real king was. That is a myth that's often purported to be part of her life, and he puts that in as well.
That's cool.
Good on you, Bill.
I don't think there's any movie versions of this.
No.
I don't even know if there's, like, a regular version of this. But there is one coming out. The second half of the Hollow Crown series is coming out, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Richard III.
I'm ready! I have one more thing I want to say. Margaret, in this play, is that crazy Margaret from Richard III?
Oh, yeah.
Mmm, yes.
Mmm, so much depth of character. So, Richard II, how does he fall in your...
Distant great-uncle, yes.
Ah, but is that then who Mortimer is referring to?
Our line was...
Cut short?
Deposed.
Ah.
Our line was deposed from the throne at Richard II.
Mm.
By the Henrys.
Ah.
Henry IV posed my great uncle, Richard II, and the throne technically should be mine.
Ah.
Should be. Isn't, but should be.
There's a lot of anger still residing there.
There's a little bit more anger than I'd like.
So because Richard II had no heirs, technically, like, you're the next in line.
Technically, yes. I would be the next in line. For the throne, if the Henrys hadn't taken it from us.
So, we're going to read a little bit of Act 2, Scene 4, which is the scene where everyone kind of retires to the garden to have a talk without King Henry VI. That's the other important thing, mm-hmm. is a lot of this fighting happens behind the boy king's back. And we don't even see Henry VI till, like, Act 4 or something crazy.
Yeah. He wasn't in the room where it happened.
He was not in the room where it happened.
Mm.
So here we go.
Right. Tut, tut, here's a mannerly forbearance. The truth appears so naked on my side that any purblind eye may find it out.
And on my side, it is so well apparelled, so clear, so shining, and so evident that it will glimmer through a blind man's eye.
Since you are tongue-tied and so loath to speak in dumb significance, proclaim your thoughts. Let him that is a true-born gentleman and stands upon the honor of his birth, if he suppose that I have pleaded truth, from office briar, pluck a white rose with me.
Let him that is no coward nor no flatterer, but dare maintain the party of the truth, pluck a red rose from off this thorn with me. I love no colors, and without all color of base insinuating flattery, I pluck this white rose with Plantagenet.
I pluck this red rose with young Somerset, and see withal I think he held the right. Stay, lords and gentlemen, and pluck no more, till you conclude that he upon whose side the fewest roses are cropped from the tree shall yield the other in the right opinion.
Good Master Vernon, it is well objected if I have fewest. I subscribe in silence.
And I.
Then for the truth and plainness of the case, I pluck this pale and maiden blossom here, giving my verdict on the white rose side.
Prick not your finger as you pluck it off, lest bleeding you do paint the white rose red, and fall on my side so against your will.
If I, my lord, for my opinion bleed, opinion shall be surgeon to my hurt, and keep me on the side where I still am.
Well, come on, who else?
Unless my study in books be false, the argument you held was wrong in law, in sign whereof I pluck a white rose too.
Now, Somerset, where is your argument?
Here in my scabbard, meditating, that shall dye your white rose in a bloody red.
Meantime, your cheeks do counterfeit our roses, for pale they look with fear, as witnessing the truth on our side.
No, Plantagenet. 'Tis not for fear, but anger, that thy cheeks blush for pure shame to counterfeit our roses, and yet thy tongue will not confess thy error.
Hath not thy rose a canker, Somerset?
Hath not thy rose a thorn, Plantagenet?
Aye, sharp and piercing to maintain his truth, whilst thy consuming canker eats his falsehood.
Well, I'll find friends to wear my bleeding roses, that shall maintain what I have said is true, where false Plantagenet dare not be seen.
Now, by this maiden blossom in my hand, I scorn thee and thy fashion, peevish boy.
Turn not thy scorns this way, Plantagenet.
Proud pole, I will, and scorn both him and thee.
It's getting heated. Those flowers.
Woo! Yeah. Thanks for joining us and listening, guys. I hope you learned a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Richard of York.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to relive this once again.
Thanks for listening to Shaky Understanding. I'm Beverly.
I'm Allison.
Deuces, peasants!
My birdkeeper friend used to say that. She's like, if I ever meet a celebrity, she has like a couple that she like loves. She's like, I would just be like, I'll let you pet a penguin. Just follow me.
And that doesn't sound sexual at all.
Like she meant both. So anyway.
Wow, Richard, things have really changed, haven't they? Women
yes.
are very free.
Oh, yes, they are. Much more so than they were back in my day.
You'd probably think petting penguins is witchcraft.
Most likely, yes. I don't even know what a penguin is.